We acknowledge that we gather on the land of the Treaty 7 people. This is the home of the indigenous people of the Stoney Nakoda and Tsuut'ina nations and several Blackfoot Confederacy nations, including the Kainai, the Pekainai, the Siksika, and the Wesley peoples. The wisdom and spirituality of these people provide a welcome to all who continue to come to this land, and they remind us to continue building a nation where inclusion, respect, and dignity are attributes. Welcome. You landed this evening in the middle of confirmation, our confirmation program, in case you didn't recognize it. It was sort of a trick to get you here. We have a tradition here in our confirmation program that we hear from people throughout the year about their lives of faith and the ways that faith and spirituality have made a difference for them as they journey through their lives. And so tonight is part of that series that we call Faith Stories. And we begin every evening in confirmation by asking the people who are present to turn to someone near them in reflection for the last week of your life, trying to identify what is a high point and what is a low point in your week. So what is the best thing you can think of that happened to you in the past 7 days, and what is among the worst things that happened to you? And so if you wouldn't mind doing that, pick someone near you, turn to them, and share what we call your high and your low. And as you do that, see if you can identify where God has been at work in your life, in your highs and your lows, and share that with one another. Thank you. Okay. I have great privilege and honor of introducing you to Mike Lickers this evening. He's a well-known Mohawk educator from Six Nations of the Grand River. He's a senior advisor of Indigenous Relations for Suncor Energy. Kind of a great wealth of things in your grasp here. He's founder and past executive director of Ghost River Rediscovery Program, and he has over 30 years of experience in leadership, outdoor education, community development, and youth leadership development. He's well recognized for his knowledge and work with Indigenous peoples in Canada and internationally, and he's continuously engaged in presentations, training seminars, and conferences. And it's our pleasure to welcome you, Michael. Mm-hmm. You'll also find he's really personable. He told me that he can go on and on and on, and he's going to have us going on and on and on. So welcome. We're very glad that you're here.
Beautiful. So first and foremost, I want to say that this is such an amazing homecoming, and I'll get to that part of the story after. The first thing I would like to say is, Sayago skanago auna skanago dizonde. Ganako go and yawango singo dizon. Great peace to everybody here today, and to your families that aren't with you, that wanted to be here, because more than likely they would like to share all of those great, wonderful things that we're going to talk about tonight. I'm going to tell you a story. Has anybody read Thomas King? Thomas King is an amazing First Nations author. And one of the things he says in a book called The Truth About Stories, or if you listen to the podcast on CBC, he says, the truth about stories is, that's all we are. How do you define yourself in the world without telling a story? So I'm going to share with you a little story. I was thought of over in Six Nations and actually born here in Calgary. That's a different class for you guys. And when I was born here in Calgary, I was born in a hospital that got blown up, and the school I went to is a museum. And I only stayed in Canada for a very brief period of time, probably till about, well, I know I got kicked out of school on the first day of kindergarten. I got into a fight with a very good friend of mine. His name was Mike Lesage. He was an Ojibwe guy. And we always got into these tussles on the way to school. And right in front of the door, we got into a big fist of cuffs, and the teacher separated us, and then I went home. And the next day, we were on a plane to Europe. I carried that for a lot of years, thinking, geez, just because I got into a fight, we got kicked out of Canada. So I was educated over in Europe, and I spoke French, Italian, and German fluently, including my own language, before coming back here to Canada. And when I came back here to Canada, I came back to a very, very interesting country. First of all, they didn't really like us, Indians. They didn't really like us. And when I say they, most of the people that I knew in Canada at that time, which was here in Calgary, didn't really like Indian people. And I went to school not very far away from here at Central Memorial High School and both at Lord Beaverbrook High School and had terrible, terrible experiences growing up as a young person. So I did the same thing that my father and my grandfather and my great-grandfather did. I served in the military the first time, jumping out of perfectly safe airplanes. And then I said to myself, well, I'm already short. I have no neck, so I really should stop doing this. And I left Petawawa, and I started driving back to Calgary and stopped at a place called Swift Current, Saskatchewan. Anybody that's from Saskatchewan's called Speedy Creek for a lot of reasons, but we won't talk about those right now. And I started working for Canadian Pacific Railway, and I was a senior foreman for CP Rail for about 8 years. I was responsible for the West Subdivision here, all the way out to the spiral tunnels. Trains were an amazing fascination. Even when I was a young kid, I had the very first train. You had to take liquid stuff and put it in the spout, and then it had smoke going around. Train only went around in circles, but it was an amazing experience. They got rid of the passenger train, and I decided to go back to school into a really interesting field coming out of France at the time, around laser technology. So I went to school, took some training in laser technology, and I was hired by Orlikon Aerospace to design and test missile systems for both the American and Canadian government. Shortly after that, transferred to Symbolic Sciences International in Vancouver to work with NASA as a digital Landsat photographer, taking the very first images of this world from... That was my job. That was kind of cool. I'm hanging out there with all these crazy people. And then all of a sudden, all of these really, really double, triple, wrapped up, double classified, double stamped classified images started coming in, and it was the outbreak of the first Gulf War. As an Aboriginal person in this country, we have these little cards called status cards or numbers that we use everywhere, so they can find you anywhere in the country if you served and you did any previous time in the military. So I had this guy knocking at the door saying, we want you. So the second time I served in the military, which was really cool, I got a chance to serve in the military wearing a kilt. Figure that one. A Mohawk guy in a kilt. Which was really cool because one of my great-great-grandfathers served in the 48th Highlanders, the Black Watch Regiment during the First World War. So one of the first members in our community to actually serve in a Highland unit. I did that for about 6 years, and I thought, geez, after we came back from overseas, thought, gee, I really got to do something with my life. And I went back to school, because that's always the easiest thing to do. Stay in school. Stay in school. And I took some really interesting stuff around youth work, youth counseling, and some really cool stuff around outdoor education. So I was doing a presentation to this group of people, and they were all judges and lawyers, and I became the first liaison in the Vancouver prison system helping young Aboriginal people to sort of navigate the system. So at Burnaby Women's, Chilliwack Sexual Offenders Camp, all the way through to New Haven Open Custody and Vancouver's Youth Detention Center. So I was the first liaison doing that, and then I decided to do this crazy thing, go up to North Vancouver Island, which is way up in the top of Vancouver on a place called Port Hardy. There's not really much up there, but a lot of good fishing. But when I first went up there, there was a mine and a whole bunch of other things. And I started working for a community up there in Fort Rupert, between Fort Rupert, Guasla, and Village Island and places. And I worked as a counselor for young kids, but teaching outdoor education as well. So I got really connected to the traditional roots of the Quaggeth people. I was brought into a family. My Quaggeth name is Kalakalus, which means walking together. I belong to a female Hamutsa family. And my mom, Wata, or Christine Joseph, is a female Hamutsa chief from the Killer Whale clan. And my father, Gordy, is a master carver who carves with people like Mungo Martin, the masters and the old master carvers. So I lived up there. My first son was born. There's 5 hospitals in North Vancouver Island. Not one of them delivers children that are at risk. So you either had to go down to Nanaimo or down to Vancouver. Decided to go back to Calgary. I came back to Calgary here and worked with an organization called Native Counseling Services Alberta as a criminal court worker, defending young kids in the system that had no representation. And then from there to a social service agency just up the road here called Hall Child and Family Services. My role there was working as a therapeutic treatment advisor, coordinator for foster care. And in 1994-95, I started my own organization called Ghost River Rediscovery. And I did that for 18 years and then retired. You don't really retire in our world, probably in yours as well, but in ours, nobody says retire is a really good age. And so I went on to do this thing because I really wanted to go back to school. So I went back to school, and they gave me this thing called permanent head damage. Oh no, they call it a PhD. And so I have this PhD now in social sciences, which means that I'm sort of a smart guy around the behaviors of human beings. Or that's what they tell me. And then, as I was doing that, this great guy and the Governor General of Canada, Michel Jean at that time in 2008, asked me to travel across the country talking to elders and a lot of people about the issue of residential school. And so I said, sure, I'll do that. And so I traveled with her across Canada, and I was at Parliament when they did the apology, and Michel said to me, do you think that it's really going to make a difference? And I said, well, it'll make a difference if Canadians make a difference. And so then we walk away from that. I went back to Suncor as a contract person, helping them to develop a youth engagement strategy. Now, that's kind of cool for an energy company to sit there and say, we really want to understand young people and communities, and we don't have anybody. We have a lot of engineers. We have a lot of people that do all the fun stuff in the energy and oil and all that kind of stuff. We really don't have an on-the-ground person that can work in relation with people and communities. So they brought me in, and that's what my current role is. I work with community investment, so a lot of the funding that the Suncor Energy Foundation contributes to organizations, specifically Indigenous organizations, those are the groups that I work with, as well as I work with Aboriginal relations and stakeholder relations, they call it, and my goal is to work with communities so that we as a company can understand them. And it's an amazing gift when an energy company sits there and says, we have a new social goal, and we really want to know how to change the way we think and act with Aboriginal people in this country. So we have an amazing opportunity in this country right now at this time, not only because of things like Senator Murray. What's his last name? Oh, Murray Sinclair. Sinclair. Ah, that's it. Perfect. Murray Sinclair, he came up with this 94 principles, or they call the Truth and Reconciliation, right? Do you remember that one? It's only 94 actions. They call it calls to actions. I am sure that you're going to walk away from here and jump on the internet and look at them, and you'll probably say, oh yeah, that guy was right. There's only 94 of them. Six of them relate to education. One relates to business. The rest relates to institutions, whether they're government. But this guy, Murray, he was a pretty cool cat. And he gave us a gift. He gave us this gift of having a better relationship with each other as Aboriginal people and non-Aboriginal people at a time when it's really desperately needed, not only in Canada, but in the world. We're living in this chaotic place that doesn't see justice. And we can't forget those things. We can't forget the stuff that happened. But let's bring it forward to a conversation where we can really get down. One of the things that Murray and Wilson and many of the other members that were on the panel had said that, you know, it's great and wonderful that everybody wants to resolve the issues. It's kind of like putting a band-aid on it. Yes, we heard it, we read it, let's move on. How do we move on as Canadians when we haven't really heard the story? So the biggest part of reconciliation is actually listening and hearing the truth. That's why it's called the Truth and Reconciliation. So when we hear the stories, horrific as they may be, but also celebratory in some cases. There were 16 kids in my dad's family. Not one of them got sent to the same school. They got shipped all over Quebec, shipped all over Ontario to go to school. Horrific stories on my mom's side on the island, sent to a place called Alert Bay. I'm not sure if anybody's familiar with Alert Bay. In Coquitlam, it's Devil's Island. For that reason, because kids just got put on there. Some of them never went home, and all of those kinds of stories are really prominent. And it doesn't mean that we have to sit there and blame anybody, because certainly that's not going to get us anywhere, right? It's an opportunity, and I think, a moment in Canadian history, where we can actually change the way we have the relationship between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people. The challenge is that it's like one of those window panes. We have a short window of time. Once it closes, we won't ever be able to come back to this moment in history and say, well, we should have done this and we should have done that, because it won't exist. We should have had better relationships with our neighbors and with our young people and with our elders. Maybe that's what the TRC can offer us. Anyway, that's me in a nutshell. Does that help? Because the challenge is, the opportunity, opportunity is, you get a chance to ask any kind of question you ever wanted to. There isn't anything that you're going to say that's going to offend me. I've been there, done it, lived it. And the idea, hopefully by sharing the story, is that through my personal experiences and my stories, it will hopefully make you feel comfortable about asking the most difficult question that you ever thought possible. It's like, think about this as an opportunity to ask an Indian anything you ever wanted to know but were afraid to. Yeah? You guys have no sense. Ha ha ha. Thank you for laughing, because that's really what it's about. Humor is a big part of our world, I can tell you that. And, you know, in non-Aboriginal communities, everybody's kind of like a little bit apprehensive about saying things because, oh, I don't want to stick my foot in my mouth. Maybe I'm saying the wrong thing. And, geez, he just said Indian. Yeah. And I do it for a reason, to have you ask those questions. So I specifically wanted to and was invited to talk to these young, inspiring, amazing people that are going to change our world. And you guys have to do it, because you know what? My generation did a terrible job. And all of these young people behind you that are watching you, they probably didn't do a very good job either. So it's not necessarily always up to you guys, but you're going to be the people that are going to change the way that we think about the world. That might be, and it might seem like it's a lot of weight on your shoulder, but I can guarantee you've already done that in a lot of ways. You've already done that within your own group of confirmation. Here's the really cool thing. Remember I said at the beginning it's kind of like homecoming? When I was young, really, really young, I was confirmed in a Lutheran church. In this city, on Crowchild Trail, there used to be a church called Grace Lutheran Church. Now, Pastor Ernest Schultz, woo-hoo-hoo, that guy was a tough character. Now, Pastor Ernest Schultz said, we're going to move the church. And I said, what do you mean you're going to move the church? I thought he was giving me one of those, you know, stories about Moses. And he said, no, we're going to move the church. And then we left Canada. So, my mom and my father gave us, I'm the oldest of nine, gave us a beautiful gift. They never forced us to be either Indigenous or non-Indigenous. My mom was adamant that we learned this side of the world as well, and my father this side of the world. So as we grew, my mom and my dad said, when you get to a place, it'll be your time to decide what you want to do with it. And it'll be your choice when you want to bring that back into your life or not. For me, I followed my father's and my grandfather's and my mom's traditions of Haudenosaunee people, or the Mohawk people, and my mom is Tuscarora, but she was raised in a Lutheran capacity. So she wanted us to understand that part of her life just as much as we understood our original Haudenosaunee roots. So it's like coming home, being here in a place that's comfortable and understanding what actually you guys are going through on a regular basis or a weekly basis when you have to sit there and listen to some old farts talking. But I can tell you that it's cool, because you get a chance to ask questions. How many times have you had the chance to ask an Indian that question? Like, what, did you really wear your hair like that when you were growing? Yes, I did. I don't know. You guys have questions. I'm going to leave it up to you to ask questions for a bit. And then we'll talk about some of the ways that my life has changed through spirituality, and not necessarily only from an Indigenous perspective, but also from all of the other communities that I've lived in and worked in. So I told you about my Kwagith name, which means walking together. I have an Nakota name, which is when my father was here, he was working in Morley. He established the Stoney Child Services Office. He opened up Nakota Lodge. He opened up the Stoney Medicine Lodge, which was a treatment center for young kids, and then he passed away just on the road going up to the 1A. And he was driving this really cool Trans Am with fancy lights because he was the chief of police too, eh? And all of a sudden, the people are looking out the window and Dad's car is sitting on the side of the road, lights going on, Dad's sitting outside, and he had a heart attack, you know? And so the community said, Catherine, who was my mom there, said, you know, we're not going to let you sit in the wind by yourself. We're going to take care of you. Your father took care of us for many years and blessed us and gave us a lot of things. So we want you to come into our family. My Nakota name is Tatanga Jacin, which means little buffalo. My mom, Catherine, and Frank Powderface, I have a huge family in Morley. I also have an Inuk name or an Inuit name. My Inuit name is Akla, and my father, Apalujik, who's a really well-known gifted storyteller, recipient of both the Order of Canada and the Inspire the National Aboriginal Achievement Awards. When we were out hunting, seal hunting, behind the wall tent, where all the stuff and you keep all your supplies. Well, I had the spear and I was chipping the ice for the seal hunt. And as I was doing that, around the front of the wall tent, a polar bear came up and grabbed the young boy and started dragging him outside of the wall tent. I'm here to tell the story. My Inuk name is Akla, which means bear. And if you tell that story in the circumpolar north of the world, they'll say, oh, you know that guy, Akla? Son of a gun. He's cool, isn't he? So that's who I am. That's my names. And they're not all my biological families, which is another kind of beautiful experience in our relationship, is that we have adopted families. Although I left the West Coast in 1994, arrived here in Calgary in 1994-95, I still have a huge relationship. I was just gifted an experience up in Port Hardy again, where I finished carving a totem pole, which will now be raised in Montreal on Sherbrooke Street for the opening of the 375th anniversary of what we call Hochelaga, the original Montreal. And this pole is a commemoration of all of the kids that went to residential school in St. Michael's Residential School. And so that pole will be raised for a period of time throughout the whole summer. It's not only celebrating 150th year anniversary of Canada, but also Montreal and the experience that residential school. So I'm always honored being with the communities that I live with. It's not an easy time when the Inuit people say that, you know, there's a lot of challenges up in our community, and then you got to think about where I work now. The difference between that. I'm an Aboriginal person, and then you're working with, you know, in some places, quite often I walk into my own community and they'll say, well, you're working for the dark side now, are you? And I said, yes, Yoda. You know? Like, give me all your gifts and tell me why I'm doing things wrong. And my mom said to me, Wata, my mom on the coast, said to me, you know, son, you're a shining star. And then you're going to go into a place that's a little square box. They're going to try and pound the edges off you. Don't let them do that. Don't let them do that. Right? But if you're not there, how are they ever going to know about us? So I walked and I talked and I spent a lot of time with elders and said, is it right that as Indigenous people, we're working in industry? And it's right. Most of the people I talked to, Catherine said the same thing. Wata said the same thing. It's a difficult journey because a lot of people in our community are really against it. So I have my hands cut out for me and a lot of work to do. That's why I need you young people to kind of do it for me. It's called a peer mentoring model. Tell you something, you tell five other people. That's what you're going to do tonight about the TRC, right? What's the guy's name again? Murray? Switched on. Okay, so like I said when I started, I'm going to really leave it open for you to ask questions. It's probably, I could sit and talk and talk and talk about amazing experiences around the world with Indigenous people, but really it's up to you guys. And there's a microphone somewhere around here so that there's a question up here in the front. Sorry, you get to be the microphone person.
I guess maybe I was wondering what your, if you had any comments on the reserve system and how it's functioning now, and what you see as a path forward with maybe some improvements.
Yeah. The interesting thing is that we don't really understand the history as we go along. So here from Manitoba to Alberta, and a little bit into the north, we have what they call number treaties, and the number treaties were specifically signed with the Crown and those people and nations, and they're really divided on how they want to approach those that question. On the other hand, you go to BC, and it was unceded territory, which basically meant, so for example, the city council in Vancouver is just turning around and saying, hey, you know, we're really sorry, because the family is still around, we're really sorry for kicking you out of Stanley Park and tearing down your three big houses to make our park. So they got to do something. And a lot of these people were pushed into little small pieces of land for the benefit of certain things. So for example, industry, expansion, economic development, the railway, right? All of the things that I worked in had a major impact on the development of Canada as a whole. If the railway didn't come all the way through, we wouldn't have had a country. That was the basis of the Constitution. You remember way back then when I was sitting with those guys? You guys have no sense of humor, holy. And, you know, McDonald's said to the rest of the provinces, this is not going to be a unified country unless we can have a national railway. In order to do that, they had to take away some of the land from people. But the Indian Act, which was put in place in 1876, previous to that it was called the Act of Civilization, which was put in place way before then, Colonization Act, was all about getting rid of the people, not necessarily keeping those things alive. So really what we have is we have this historic, archaic system that people don't really know what to do with, and yet it's been their home for hundreds of years. So how do you take somebody that lives in Acadia, or even here in Southwood, and you say, your family's lived here for two generations, but, you know, sorry, you got to go. And you're not going to get compensated for it. You just got to go. We're taking your property and your land and everything else, and see you later. And you had no right to stand up. First of all, it was against the law. We had no right to retain counsel. As Aboriginal people, we weren't allowed to hold lawyers. We weren't allowed to engage lawyers, so we couldn't challenge the government on taking the land. So that's one thing. You go back historically enough, and communities are still struggling with trying to deal with that. How do we deal with a piece of land that was given to us, but really that's not the only area of land that we used? We had greater use of land, right? Which is where the term traditional territory comes from, which is another challenge, because now we're not just talking about an identified 20 acres of lands out in BC, but we're talking about thousands and thousands of acres. For example, the Tsleil-Waututh, all the way up the inside Burrard Inlet to the outside, Squamish, way up north, all the way down to Vancouver. But they were only given a small piece of 20 acres of land, because that's all that Douglas could afford at that time. So he bought land for the Indians and put them there. That was it. So, yes, there's a bit of a challenge with trying to identify land and land base and so on. I don't think the people on the reserves really want it to be that way still. They would prefer to have no walls, no fences, no barriers. But it's the government system that's been put in place that's holding them a lot in those areas. Now, again, go back to, this is our home. This has been our traditional land for hundreds of years. If we went to that kind of basis, I was talking to my American friend over here who comes from Texas, and I said to him, I said, you know, before you came up here, holy smokes, my people extended all the way down to Florida with the Tuscarora, all the way up the eastern seaboard, but somebody took care of them a long time ago, so they have no home, they have no homeland. Syracuse, where the Onondaga live, is the last of the outposts for the Haudenosaunee community. And then they were forced into different places. On top of that, we were given this amazing opportunity to support England in the development and creation of Canada in the War of 1812. Yes? Do you guys read about that stuff in school? Yeah. Go to school. Stay in school. War of 1812 happens. The Mohawk people, the Haudenosaunee community, they side with the British, and all of this stuff happens. You know, the Mohawk people saved this country three or four times without firing a single shot in Fort Detroit. 200 warriors defended all of the United States military trying to evade Canada. So for doing those kinds of great, wonderful things in the War of 1812, we were given the right to a piece of land. And it was called the Haldimand Tract. And that tract of land was set aside specifically for the Six Nations of Indians for protecting Her Majesty and the Loyalists in North America. which meant all of your relatives that lived in Ontario and Quebec, they were all protected by my people and given a piece of land. That piece of land was eventually taken away, and that's now Toronto all the way down to Niagara Falls. In the Royal Proclamation in 1763, my friends, 1763, a long time ago, but I was there, when King George said, if you're going to do anything on this land, rightfully so, you need to negotiate with the original inhabitants of the land. So now, all the conversation about treaty and reserves goes all the way back to the Royal Proclamation, 1763. So, Canadian government has done a really terrible job keeping up with the times. That's the challenge. Get rid of the Indian Act? Perfect. That would be an amazing thing, although it holds the government accountable for certain things that they did for a century of time. And it's hard to do now, right? So there's got to be a way to have that relationship build and get to a better place. I just don't know exactly what that's going to be yet. I know in my community, they took my land away because I served in the military. They took my status away because I served in the Canadian military to fight for your country. When I was born in this country, I was not considered a Canadian citizen. I was a ward of the state. And it wasn't until March 31st, 1960, Section 14.2 of the Canada Elections Act changed, allowing you, as Aboriginal people, the right to be Canadians, the right to vote in this country. My friends, women had the right to vote in 1930, maybe a little bit later in Quebec, but the right to vote in this country a heck of a lot earlier than I did. People who immigrated to this country had the right and more rights than Aboriginal people did. So when we talk about land, it's a big, big story, big question, and I don't know the answer for it.
Any country you can go.
Yeah,
you can go to Italy, for instance.
Yeah. Yeah, the principalities in Italy.
It's the same thing.
Yeah, and the interesting.
It was taken away from some people and given to others.
Sure.
And that's, so you really can't go back and say, okay, if this was your tract of land, we can't say, oh, we'll just give it to you.
Well,
yeah, there you go.
And the difference is that we actually made a relationship with the Crown in order to do that. Not to put us in, not to isolate us and put us, but to have equal relationship. It wasn't a surrender. We didn't surrender the land. And where I come from, we have a thing called the two-row wampum belt, or what they call the constitution, the relationship between us and the Dutch people when they first came here before the British and French. What the belt says is that you stay in your canoe and we'll stay in our canoe. Don't force your opinions and laws on us. We won't force our opinions and laws on you. And that relationship was great and wonderful until the French came. You know, and then you've got the French fighting with the British about some furry little creature. And then the next thing you know, they're getting us to fight against ourselves. So we have now the Iroquois and the Algonquin people fighting and warring against each other. It's horrific. The thing is that the relationship that we have with the Crown never said that we surrendered our land, ever. So we go back to the Crown now and say, hang on a second, where did you get the right to do that? And the point where it severs the right was the implementation of the Indian Act. Because then it reduces our laws and reduced any responsibility that Aboriginal people had in this country. It's a crazy thing. It's a really nasty document. It still exists. It's only changed once or twice, 1982, maybe a little bit before in the 50s. But certainly, that document is still the same. Somebody over here had a question. I don't know if that helps, but sorry.
I have a question.
Tough question.
What is the typical level of education that that the young people, the Aboriginal young people achieve?
Yeah. So the typical range of education now, I think, is increasing. And it's dramatically changing because there are people like myself out there saying, stay in school. You need to have an education. There's a relation. And, you know, it's really hard. It's really hard because I remember going home the first time after I finished my master's, and people in my community said, well, you're an apple. Mike, you're an apple. You know, you're red on the outside, but you're all white on the inside. You think like a white person now. And you know, it might sound like it's fun, but holy smokes, those are tough things to have to deal with as a young person. So you do a degree, you do a master's, and you go home, and people are ridiculing you for advancing yourself. And on the other hand, there's a real push in some communities to really get a lot more people educated. So this year, the University of Calgary graduated 113 First Nations, Métis, and Inuit students. Not all together, but as a combined, what they call FNMI, First Nations, Métis, and Inuit people. 113. That's higher than the year before, which was 82. And higher than the year before. So it's gradually increasing. And it's not in traditional roles like social services. We're going into engineering. We're becoming doctors, lawyers. One of my uncles was the first lawyer to sit on the Ontario Bar Association, Norman Liquors. Right? You go to our reserve, if it's not a Liquors or a Hill, it's a miracle. So yes, we are changing the way we do that. And more communities are being engaged in education in a very different way. So the northern communities have access to internet so they can do online schooling more than they could before. When you go to schools on reserves, they're horrific conditions. They don't have the same kind of benefit as you have or we have in the cities, right? And yet, you know, do you send your kids away to go to school again? That's a really difficult experience to have to go through.
But some of them don't have to go far.
Some of them don't have to go very far. Yeah.
Close.
And they have their own high school. They do now because of that same reason, but they give their students the option of whether they want to come into town or whether they want to stay on the reserve and go to school, and so does Morley. They can go into Cochrane or to Canmore to go to school. But yeah, it's difficult. And then, on top of that, your parents, who were sent to residential school, how are they going to support you in education? Everything. You have to pay for everything. It's not education is not free. That's a misconception, I can tell you that right now. No, it's not. My PhD cost $85,000. Do you know how much I paid out of my own pocket? $85,000. Tuition is not free unless your community can afford to give each student pockets of money. But that's generated through revenue that the community has. It's not government given to us. There's certainly not every community has the ability to do that. The Blood Reserve, they try as much as they can through their business ventures, to set aside money. Hobima was doing the same thing with their oil royalties. They set aside a bit of money for people to get some stuff. But it's not a given. You do not get free education. You don't get free tuition. You know, misconception. Yes?
All of the things that are pressing for the Indian nations, water, education, go down the list. In your opinion, which is the most pressing one? Which is the thing that should be handled first? Or is there one?
Yeah, that's a tough question. That's a really tough one. 282 reserves in Canada without fresh drinking water. 282 reserves in Canada without fresh drinking water. 282 reserves in Canada without safe drinking water. Where in the world would we hear that same kind of commentary and not do something about it? 282 reserves without safe drinking water. And some of those are our neighbors. There's a boil water advisory in Sotina. You have to get your water shipped in from Canmore if you live in Morley. And they're right along the same river system as we are in Calgary. You know, we have the highest rate of suicide in the world. Predominantly young men are killing themselves off faster. You go up to the Arctic, they have a super high rate of suicide. I think it's probably 7 in 10. When I was in Newfoundland, Labrador, I went to a school of young kids, and these young kids, grade 3, grade 4, some of them already had rope marks around their neck from trying to take their life. Part of that stems to, you know, go back to the story of my dissertation. I think a lot of it stems to personal identity. My father would always say, if you know who you are and where you come from, you'll always have a dream in the future, son. And I said, okay, Dad, and thank you for sharing me my world. But I can tell you that there are a heck of a lot of kids that don't know who they are. They don't know where they come from. And they've been disconnected for a multitude of reasons. One stemming back to residential school. We have 65% of the children in care in the province of Alberta are First Nations. That's a staggering statistic. Where in the world would we have that kind of stuff? Where would we allow that kind of stuff to happen? I don't understand it. And the more I talk about it, the more it just sits there and says, when somebody says, what's the key, what's the most, I don't know. I don't have an answer for you, sir. To tell you the truth, there are a multitude of social issues stemming back from, so I'm just going to throw this as a possibility, only because I'm an educator and I love having people think about things. How many people here have children? Okay, now all of your children were forcibly taken away from you. On top of that, you're not allowed to leave the reserve. On top of that, the Indian agent, who this is my young friend here, he's the Indian agent, he just turned around and said, none of you are going to get your rations this week because you have that kind of authority and control. And my grandmother watched 16 of her kids get ripped away from her and sent to different schools. When I met my grandmother before we left Canada to go to Europe, she was in the hospital because she was having problems with her liver. And I think she drank quite a bit. I didn't actually see it, but I'm pretty sure she did. And my grandfather, same thing. He came back from the Second World War, was told that he lost his property. He was told that he was enfranchised, so he had to live in Brantford, Ontario. He was told that he wasn't allowed to work at certain jobs because of his employment. And then all of his kids were taken away from him. Now, I don't know what that would do to you as a human being, but I can certainly tell you that from most of the people that I know and talk to along my journey with Mikhail Jean and many others, part of that answer was in a bottle. And if you drank, you didn't have to worry about feeling the pain. And so who do you think was on the outside of the reserves from around 1950, 1960s onwards? The rum runners, right? Because A, it was illegal to have alcohol in a reserve. The Indian agent could take you and throw you in jail. It was $35 and 10 days in jail if you got caught with alcohol. But he actually managed it all too, right? So he would have people on the outside bring it all in, charge you double and all that kind of stuff. They got rid of the Indian agents probably around 1980s, later part of 1970s, and they were kind of like, they were pretty much like the end-all, be-all on the reserve. So we have all these social issues that I don't know how to answer my grandmother's story. My father, who never, ever spoke about his experience in residential school, ever, and I never, ever witnessed my father ever crying. Until 2 weeks before he passed away, we both got recalled back into the military at the same time. My father was the commanding officer for the Calgary Highlanders here, and I was over in Vancouver with the Seaforth Highlanders there. And my father said to me, he said, you know, I want to apologize to you because I didn't do the right thing. I said, Dad, don't ever say that, you know. I haven't been hurt ever, never broken a bone in my body. Emotionally, I'm stable. Physically, I'm healthy. Spiritually, I have the best of both worlds. And emotionally, I'm stable as well. So why would you say that? And he said, because I never gave you the things that they took away from me. I never gave you the stories, the language, all of that kind of stuff. I thought I wanted to do that. So my Aunt Lori, who's the matriarch of our family, is the storyteller, and she tells all of the stories because my father wasn't able to. Right? So I don't know if that kind of experience has anything to do with social issues on reserves, but I'm pretty sure it did. And that experience lasted for 125 years. The last residential school in Canada closing in 1996 on the Gordon Reserve in Saskatchewan. The first school was the Mush Hole, we call it the Mush Hole, which was established by Her Majesty the Queen, on our reserve. And it's called Her Majesty's Chapel of the Mohawks. Right? So that whole experience, I'm pretty sure, has had some really negative experiences. Both for the continued education, people talking about education. Sorry, do we have one? Okay.
How and when are indigenous names given to children?
It depends on the community. So quite often when people are born, they're given names. My original name is Waganahaskun, which means white eagle. So usually I carry all of those things with me. And this represents my traditional name. And I come from the Turtle Clan, part of the Upper Mohawk Confederacy. So this A lot of these things seem like they're just pictures and images, but there's really relevance to everything that we have. And inside here, there's the tail of a buffalo, represents my traditional Nakota name, Tatanga Jusin. And then I carry the claws from the bear when I travel in the Arctic. My Anuk name is Akla, which means bear. On the west coast, Kalakalus, which means walking together, I carry a stick, which is a stick representing who I am and where I come from. Those names are not often, and you know, they're not passed on to certain people ever again until somebody in the family re-initiates that name. So Kalakalus, meaning walking together, belonged to a relative a long time before in their family, and they gave me the honor of now carrying it. So it can happen when you're born. And then what we had was we always had rites of passage. I don't know if it's a little bit different nowadays. Kids get a driver's license, or you turn 18 and you can vote and all that kind of stuff, and now you're an adult, right? Well, in our community, you had rites at certain points of your life. Marriage is a rite of passage. Death is a rite of passage, all of those kinds of things. But for a young person, confirmation is a rite of passage as well. That kind of stuff we would do in an indigenous community, and you may earn a different name at each point. Does that help? Yeah. How are they chosen? Yeah. So my father said to me when I grew up, I asked him, I said, why did you call me this? And he said, have you ever seen an eagle fly with only one wing? And I said, no, Dad. I didn't know whether it was going to be one of these. Because he was infamous for, you know, we'd be driving down the road going to Frankfurt, and there'd be cows on this side, cows on this side here'd be white cows, and this side here'd be black cows. And he said, see those ones? That's where your white milk comes from. Brown cows on this side, see those ones? That's where your brown milk comes from. Yeah, it's just crazy stories, eh? So I asked him that, and that's what he said to me. He says, an eagle has to fly with two wings. So you need to have a balance of our world and a balance of this world that you live in now. And if you have that, you'll always be able to soar to great heights. So my name is Wagana Haskan. And he gifted me with that name. And until it changes in my community, that's the name that I carry. It's not always the first thing you see at night, or the first thing you see when the child's born. That's a stereotype as well. Names are quite often thought about and really, really intensely considered before they're given to somebody. So most of the time it was women in our community. They knew that this individual had an innate quality. And from that, they were able to determine what the name would be. And they would confer amongst the clan mothers. They would have ceremony, and then all of a sudden the name was given. You can have this name, you can have this name, you can use this name. You can't use this name, you can't use this name. Yeah. Yes?
Mike, we hear these horrific stories now, and I think sometimes we think, okay, these are things that happened in the past, but we're going to make it better now. Mm-hmm. But the stories we're hearing right now, the things that are happening now, are just as appalling and sometimes more so. Mm-hmm. Are we doing a good enough job of listening? Do Aboriginal people really feel that non-Aboriginal people are listening? Are they hopeful?
Yeah.
I want to be hopeful. But do they feel some hope?
I'm going to say most of the people I talk to, yes. You know, I mean, that would... I can't speak on behalf of all Indigenous people in Canada, certainly no different than you could speak on behalf of all Canadians. Yeah. The communities that I work with and I'm connected to, I certainly can. There's hope for the Quaggith people for recognizing the Douglas Treaties finally for the first time, to being honored and recognized as a nation of people in that territory, that their rights were taken away. The Nakota people here, Banff National Park just implemented the first buffalo back into the park again. That was one of the things that one of my uncles, Sykes Powderface, has been working on for 20 years. You know, so stuff like that is, and the buffalo is a really spiritual animal for the Nakota and the Plains people. And it may seem like it's trivial in some ways, but it's a huge, huge thing. All the way through to my community where, you know, we have all of these things that are going on in this world, and we're trying to understand them from our Haudenosaunee perspective, which is different. Leroy Little Bear wrote an article, and he calls it Jagged Worldviews Colliding. You know, non-Aboriginal people think a certain way, and Aboriginal people think another way. And sometimes those things don't always fit together. And in my dissertation, I wrote it as, my father said to me, as soon as you write something down, it's wrong. Not because the information's wrong, but because the way you interpret it will be different than the way I interpret it. So if I don't fully explain myself, and even if I did, you may take it from a different perspective.
Yeah. I'm going to hang on to this mic for just a minute more and ask one more question. I write stories, and I appreciate hearing an oral storyteller. If I wrote a story and put a character in that story who had done everything that you have done in your life, people would say, no way. This is not possible. You made this guy up. He had to have lived 140 years to have done all of this.
Well, I was hanging out with Mackenzie when they did the train. That was my first job, remember?
Yeah.
Yes, thank you. We have this amazing medicine. I brought some of the stuff. I know you guys are really, really blessed with this medicine that women, they try to hide it all the time, but it's called oil of Olay. And you guys are really, really good at it. In our world, we just call it bear grease. Bear grease is an amazing thing. You put it on your skin and it just does wonders. I've got a couple of things. We've got, okay, another question. Yes. Okay.
You probably know about Canadian Lutheran World Relief, where we send money over to Africa so they can drill wells and have good drinking water.
Yeah.
What should we be doing as a congregation of Christians to do things in our country to help the native people?
That's an amazing question, beautiful question. And what I would say first and foremost is, though we send money overseas internationally, we know little about the impact of that in its long term. So for example, now we're looking at, we sent over a lot of money into Sudan, south and north. And right now, today we heard that South Sudan is in a spiraling, first time ever famine. But we invested a lot of money into water there and all this kind of stuff. And that was a man-made kind of conflict that resulted in this famine. The question in Canada, I think, is, and a young guy stood up in Suncor at one of the gatherings and said, you know, maybe it's not us as Aboriginal people that are the problem, maybe it's you guys. That kind of blew the lid off of all of the executive leaders at Suncor. Because they were like, us? We the problem? So I don't know exactly what we can do, but if we don't reach out and ask the question, we're not ever going to know. And I don't know how many people have actually gone to a community, whether it's our neighbors here in Sotina, or whether it's a relationship with Siksika or Kainai or Piikani or Nakota people, and said, hey, look, we've got this amazing congregation of people that really have done some fantastic work overseas and internationally, and we want to have a better understanding of what we can do here. There's congregations on each of those reserves. Have a relationship with them and find out really what would make a difference. Is it water, or is it the basic essentials? So, what's his name? Made it into a pyramid. So, hang on, you guys all know this kind of stuff. Huh? Yeah, Maslow. Maslow's theory of hierarchy, it actually stemmed from the Blackfoot people. You guys, do you know that? No, I'm serious. It was taken from the Blackfoot Confederacy, and Maslow made millions off of it without giving any credible sources and recognition to the Blackfoot people. It just came to light in academic literature not more than a year ago. So Maslow's theory states that these hierarchy of needs are the basis of indigenous principles of life. All of the seven, what we call seven teachings or seven grandfather teachings, whether you want to look at it as a hierarchy or as a circle, all of those things are important. So maybe it's not water. Maybe it's not the water that's the big issue. Maybe it's like, geez, you know, it'd be nice if our kids went to school and they had breakfast, lunch, and supper, because they don't have meals for 2 or 3 days, and they got to try and focus on an education, and that's hard to do. And maybe that's not the only thing. I don't know. I don't have an answer for it unless we actually reach out and ask. Yeah.
Sense of a lot of people is that the government's giving them all this money on the reserves, but they just blow it, drink it, something like that. How do we counteract that kind of idea?
Well, you're right in a lot of ways. I mean, there has been major misappropriation of funds. So think about this. Mr. Indian agent here and chief and counsel. Chief and counsel went to residential school. The highest grade you can get to is grade 3 and grade 6. That's the highest you can get to. And then you got kicked out of school. So grade 3, grade 6, Indian agent finally gets punted off the reserve. There's an elected chief and counsel. He's got grade 3. He's got grade 6. They're managing a budget of about, I don't know, $14, $16 million for a small community. And that looks pretty good sometimes, eh? You know, like I'm going to buy off some of my friends. I'll stay in power. And so one of the great stories that Jon Snow from Morley would say was his greatest mentor in his being a chief for the community was the Indian agent. So he saw how the Indian agent managed the community. And if that's all you saw, that's how you ran your community. Now it's changing. There are some communities that actually have in their bylaws that you cannot sit on chief and council or any part of the council environment, whether that's in business, without having a degree. So people are changing. But remember that this whole experience, you know, didn't change. 1960, folks. 1960, Aboriginal people were legally allowed to cross the line and go into cities without being charged by this guy. 1960, 1965, we had these little passes that they still had to sign saying, yes, you can leave the reserve without being charged. That's not that long ago in my history. If you look at it from a linear perspective, it's not that long ago, right? No, at all. So one more up, young guy. I'll come back in a second. Yes. I will. But the young guy here has had his hand up for quite a while, and then I'll come back over here.
My question was just, what is, you know, understanding that, you know, Aboriginal people feel the equity between the earth and humans, and what is, in your role then, what is Suncor learning, I guess, around that attitude of equity, I guess?
Yeah, it's a huge question, and we're still working on it. We're trying to get better at understanding how we can be better for and with communities as opposed to, you know, doing things for them all the time. So what are ways that we can help them help themselves as opposed to us doing all the stuff for them? So instead of giving money, maybe the best way to put it is, instead of being transactional, we want to be transformational. That's the way of looking at it. So yes, sir, you had a question.
Yeah, Mike, I got a question.
Mm-hmm.
And how many tribes in Canada would allow you to speak the way you are speaking?
Yeah.
The reason I'm asking that, because the book of Dancing with Dependency, written by
Calvin Hoyne,
chief of and he spoke some of the things you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when we talk about dependency, you know, and I think a lot of Canadians are saying, all right, $30 billion, I think it is today, that Canadian taxpayers are paying. When we have 220-some chiefs get paid more than a prime minister. So I'm just saying, happiness is, if you would talk to every chief and say, listen and open up, wow.
Yeah. There are 630 different nations, First Nations in Canada, and I'm including Métis and Inuit people. They certainly haven't given me the right to stand in front of you and speak. I'm speaking to you from my families and my community and who I am. And from those positions, I can certainly tell you that our communities are doing the best they can to change the way that they're perceived by communities as well as engaging in communities. Also, think about things like this. Your government, in the sponsorship scandal, spoofed how many millions and billions of dollars at every turn, every political party in the Canadian government since McDonald has done something of a disservice to Canadian populations and Canadian citizens. No different than Indigenous communities. At certain points, we had chiefs that took the money and misappropriated it and used it incorrectly. On the other hand, the money that you think that the federal government gives to communities doesn't necessarily go directly to communities. It goes to the Department of Indigenous Affairs. the Department of Indigenous Affairs then disperses it beyond that. So now you've got this whole engine over here that it's required to work. And they're all white people that work in the Indigenous Affairs Department. Maybe not all of them, but most of them. So yes, I certainly don't speak on behalf of all Indigenous people in the world, although they would surely love me to do that. I do the best that I can to talk to my own people. I remember one time in our office, we have this thing called the Aboriginal Awareness Training. It's a web-based training and then a face-to-face training. And I said to my co-trainer, wouldn't it be cool one day to have white awareness on reserves? Like to actually go and talk to them and say, this is what white people are all about, you know? You got a lot of misconceptions about those white people. Holy smokes. Some of my best friends are white people. I live next to white people. Yes, so there is an opportunity, and it's slowly happening. It's definitely happening. So, some of the stuff in my world, when I get up in the morning, no different than most of you do, or when you go to sleep, hopefully you guys are doing this every night, saying your prayers, whether you choose to put your hands together, kneel, or whether you sit beside your bed and you say, God, thank you for this amazing day. Thank you for allowing me to open my eyes and see such beautiful things in this world. And thank you for all the people in my life. That's the same thing Indigenous people do. We get up, we take medicine like this sage that grows all over Calgary, specifically over here in Fish Creek, up around Nose Hill. We roll it into a small ball, and it has this purification that every denomination in the world had the same thing. When the people first walked in the chambers after what do you call those things in the church? No, the entranceway in.
Narthex.
Yeah. And the guy was always standing there with the stuff, and then he led the way into the church, and everybody was walking behind him. Well, his intention was to clear the path of all negativity and bad spirits before the people entered into the church. It's no different than the way we do things. We give the Creator, we call, or Singo Dizo, the opportunity to give blessings and thanks for everything that we have in our life. So we wake up in the morning, we light it, because the gift that comes from the water or the earth is a shell or any kind of rock, something that comes from the earth. Once the medicine is lit, the smoke comes, and we take it and we clear our mind, we clear our eyes, our ears, and our mouth, and over our body. And we'll say things like, you know, in case I see anything negative in my life, that I have the ability to see it and turn it into something positive. If I hear things that are negative, I have the ability to speak wisely and carefully and to change it into something positive. If I speak, that I speak truth and as best as I can with my relations with other people. And over my body, because the Creator gave me this shell to look after, and some of us are good at it and some of us are not so good at it, like me. And then I'll take some of the smoke and I'll carry it to my heart. Most of the time you'll hear a term or a phrase called all my relations. And that basically means that in my prayers, if I've forgotten anybody, all my relations. It's like when you say amen or amen, 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 all men, which was the interpretation. So the medicines that we use, from there to the sacredness of our pipes. This is a pipe that comes from an old man named Morris Crow. He's no longer here. It's an effigy of an eagle, which is my name. And there's no funny tobacco that goes in this. It's actually tobacco that I have to make. So there's certain ways that you can gift and make medicines. Most of us used to know all of those kinds of things. My mom on the coast is often sought after for her knowledge of traditional medicines. I can't pass this around, but I'll just show it with you. So this is a pipe that comes from the Blackfoot Confederacy. Morris Crow was an elder that comes from there. This pipe was passed on from his family to me in honor and recognition of my son dancing with him for the last 20 some odd years with those people. Yes, it's a stone. It's called a black stone. Some of them will use red stone, and they're carved. Sorry? I'm not exactly sure the make of the stone, but It's not a soapstone.
No, it's not.
Yeah. And combined with that is the knowledge of medicines. So we have, you know, things like making our own tobacco. All of the medicines. So another crazy friend of mine, oh man, and this guy likes to party. This guy's first name was David. And I think his last name is Suzuki. And so we used to hang out, and I would tell him all these kinds of crazy things, and he eventually wrote it in a book. But one of the things that he said when we were talking was, you know, Mike, most of these young people nowadays can walk around the world, and they can sing, I don't know, 5, 10, 15 songs, just like that, eh? Right off the top of your head. Logos and slogans and stuff like that, Nike and all those kinds of things, just like that. But they probably couldn't walk outside the door in amongst the trees and find 5 plants that could save their life. Yes? Or I could be wrong. It's an assumption. But maybe you couldn't walk outside the door and find 5 plants that will save your life. In here, walking around the side of your building, the side of the church, in the front of the church, most of these medicines are right there. So willow bark, scrape off the willow bark, it's aspirin. The inside of root, mullein, you guys don't have around here, but that's something that you'd end up trading off into another community for a wild mullein. Willow bark, bear root, rat root, another herba ursa or bear berry, which is another plant that just grows outside. It has a little red berry on the top, and you can use that. This is a tobacco that goes into our pipes, and it's never had carcinogen tobacco or this kind of tobacco inside the pipe. People give this to you, and it's an acknowledgement of a bunch of things in ceremony, but really it's not what you're going to put inside of a pipe and smoke. You never inhale the tobacco anyway. You take the tobacco, and you blow the smoke into your mouth, and you clean your body off the same way you would with a smudge. So a lot of the ceremonies were involved like that. We all carry these pouches with different kinds of medicines. So if... can't really let you try it, because then you'll be able to sing like forever. But if you had asthma, the old people use this stuff like you, it'd be like eating licorice, my friend. So you take a piece of this, some people, old people would take it and put it on the wood stoves, because they all had wood stoves in the house, and the smoke would eventually billow into the house, and you'd think, ah, smoke, geez, I got asthma. This removes the alveoli off the sac of your lungs and allows you to breathe. It's amazing medicine. So a lot of this stuff, people have lost the ability to know how to use it and the significance for it. When we get together in ceremony, no different than here, we purposely gather our medicines, our sacred things, and some people have the permission to use different kinds of medicines. My mom on the West Coast treats a certain kind of cancer. She treats, what do you call that stuff? Arthritis through Douglas fir bark, pitch. Like, there's amazing stuff that they use. The arbutus tree mixed with a bunch of other plants has the potential of treating some cancers. And the problem that my mom would say is that, you know, once we tell non-Aboriginal people about this medicine, then they'll just ravage it and take it away like they did other ones. So Aboriginal people are sometimes a little bit apprehensive about sharing things. Doesn't mean they know the answers to everything.
But. Go on, like I worked in mad medicine, mm-hmm. and I actually worked with the natives years ago, 50 years ago.
Yep.
You can't use these and the other ones, because those work. So then you've got a double working thing, and then you're going to kill yourself by overworking.
Yes, and
you've got to stay on one side of this.
It was quite often that the comment, there was a young girl in Six Nations that had cancer, and she chose not to go through chemotherapy, but the doctors had already started, and they told her that the chemotherapy was going to work. She left, went to traditional medicine, got really, really sick, and it's too late to go back to it. So you're right. I think you either make a conscious decision to follow or follow.
I worked through the Department of Indian and Eskimo Affairs in those days, 50 years ago.
Yeah.
Probably
didn't need it.
When they actually
Yeah. Full bunch of prescriptions. I wish we could get to that place again. Maybe one day we will. Yeah. I'm hoping so. Yeah. It's perfect. It's amazing. And most of us are going back to some of that knowledge anyway, you know, because we realize that living in this world is not an easy thing. But I definitely wanted to leave it as an opportunity for any other questions before I do two things. One is I'm going to share a song with you, and then I'm going to tell you a story. Or maybe I'll tell you a story and then share a song. What do you think? Story first? Okay. Anybody have any other questions that I can answer and address? I know it's a really short time and there's lots of questions and I don't have all of the answers. I certainly don't profess to know everything. What I can say is that, again, it's an amazing opportunity in Canadian history to take the chance to change things.
What different things did the First Nations try to cure with medicine?
So things like, you know, when non-Aboriginal people first came here, there was an epidemic of smallpox, and there was epidemics of measles. Scurvy? Yeah, but you know what we did with scurvy was they had, especially out here, what they did was they, white pork or salt fish or salt pork was the nasty stuff. But what they did was they took wild meat, buffalo, mixed it with berries, predominantly juniper, blueberries, Saskatoons, and dry meat, and made it into a paste with grease or bear fat, and called it pemmican. And pemmican was able to allow the people that navigated here, the Palliser expedition and many others that had things like scurvy, and give them the much needed protein, nutrients, and plant medicine to survive. So that's one, scurvy for sure. We had smallpox, we had the common cold or the flu or whatever, I think were probably equally things. And some of the elders would try as best as they could, but they really didn't know the medicines that we had at that time. Certainly weren't able to deal with things like smallpox. And there wasn't anything that you did that got rid of smallpox, and the whole community essentially perished because of the smallpox epidemics. Great question. Any other questions that I can help answer? No? Tell you a story. Okay. My father was an amazing storyteller. I told you about that, eh? And he would often say to me, you know, son, sit down, I'm going to tell you a story. And I'd always be worried about whether it was a true story or a story like in the house that my dad grew up in, 16 kids, one bedroom house. They still have it. My uncle owns this house still. And all of the kids stayed in the living room in a circle. And when you got old enough, out the door. And my dad's responsibility was to look after the stove, and he was probably fourth from the bottom, 16 kids. And he kept telling me the story about a pet rat. I said, Dad, you didn't have a pet rat. And you know, stop complaining about going and walking to school, because I used to have to ride my bike uphill with no tires. You know, those kinds of stories? So when my dad passed away, all my uncles gathered around and sat there and said, you know, your dad would get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and ride that damn bike with no rubber tires up to the farm. He'd work at the farm, and then he rode it up to school. So some of his stories are true. This is one of them. In the series of stories in the Haudenosaunee culture, we often say that it's not appropriate to tell stories in the summer, in the fall, or in the spring. Those are really important times in our lives. Spring, harvesting or planting our fields, summer tending to them, in the fall harvest, in the winter are the winter ceremonies, and we have the opportunity then to sit down and tell stories. The old people would come into the longhouse and they would sit, and there would be days and days of feasting on the moon that just finished passing, which is the 13th moon of the year. The cycles we follow are through the moons. And this last ceremony is the time when the old people would come in and start telling stories, and there would be a big feast. So when I was young, I would often fall asleep through all the stories, and I'd ask my dad the next morning, well, so what happened? He says, you'll have to wait till next year. And I had to wait till next year. He would never, ever tell the story again. And there's a couple of reasons why. One is I'm sure that he would say them so that I would never forget them. And the second is that he would say them so that I said it the exact same way he said it. So I'm going to give you a condensed version of one of these stories. And it's called The Gift. A long time ago, before human beings came to this world, the Creator held counsel with all of the animals. And he said to the animals, I have a really powerful and special gift to give to the human beings when they come down here. But I don't want them to find it too easy. Because if they find it too easy, they're just going to hurt themselves and all of the other people. So the animals got into a circle and they talked amongst themselves. And the buffalo came up to the Creator and he said, hey, give it to me and I'll take it way out into the forest. The prairie grasses, the two-leggeds, the human beings, they'll never find it there. The Creator thought for a moment and he said, no, I'm afraid one day the human beings, they're going to need that grass and they're going to cut it all down and they'll find that gift before they're ready to use it. They won't know what to do with it and they'll just hurt themselves and all of the other people. So buffalo goes back out into the circle and Ojinja, the bear, comes up. And he says, hey, give it to me and I'll take it into the mountains. I'll even put it inside the mountains. The human beings, the two-leggeds, they'll never find it there. Creator thought for a second and looked at Ojinja, the bear, and he said, no, I'm afraid one day the human beings, they're going to be able to go up those mountains. They'll even be able to go through those mountains, and they'll be able to take those mountains down, and they'll find that gift before they're ready to use it. They won't know what to do with it, and they'll just hurt themselves and all of the other people. So Ojinja goes back into the circle. Salmon comes down into the circle and says, give it to me, and I'll take it down the rivers and the lakes. I'll even take it to the ocean. The two-leggeds, the human beings, they'll never find it there. Creator thought for a second, and he said, no, I'm afraid the human beings, they're going to make machines, they'll travel through the rivers to the lakes and even to the deepest part of the oceans, and they'll find that gift before they're ready to use it. They won't know what to do with it, and they'll just hurt themselves and all of the other people. So Salmon goes back into the circle, and Eagle flew down and sat beside the Creator and said, hey, give it to me, and I'll take it way up into the sky. I'll even take it past the stars. The two-leggeds, the human beings, they'll never find it there. Creator thought for a second. He says, nope, I'm afraid the human beings, they'll make machines, they'll travel through the skies, and they'll be able to find that gift before they're ready to use it. And they'll just hurt themselves and all of the other people. So the Creator sat amongst the animals and posed the question again. I have this really powerful gift I want to give to the human beings when they come down here. But I don't want them to find it too easy. If they find it too easy, they're going to hurt themselves and all of the other people. So the council gathered even closer amongst themselves, and as they were doing that, this little mouse ran up on the shoulder of the Creator and whispered into his ear. And then he started laughing and smiling. He said, that's it. That's exactly where we're going to put it. And all of the other wise animals stopped and looked around and they said, which of the wise animals came up with the answer? And the Creator said, well, I've learned two things. First, it's really important to listen to the little people in our lives because they have so much to teach us. It's important to listen to the people that don't talk the same way as us, that don't hear the same way as us, because they have lots to teach us. So we need to listen to those people that don't speak or speak differently. But even more importantly, the second thing is, when the human beings come down to this world, I know exactly where we're going to put that gift. We're going to put it inside themselves because they'll never look for it there. And only when they're ready to do amazing, beautiful things for other human beings will they know where that gift is. And so the Creator gave a gift to each of us. And he said, my dad said after the story, he said, son, you have a powerful gift. You're an amazing storyteller. You're a really cool human being, all those kinds of things. But what's going to make it even more powerful is if you give it away freely without expecting anything ever in return, and 1,000 more gifts will come your way. And so for indigenous people, sometimes we're poor. Sometimes we walk on the streets with a hat saying, give me some money. I'm serious. And we all have the ability to change those things because we all have gifts. Some of us, my dad would say, are amazing storytellers musicians, singers, people who do amazing things. Now you know that you have that gift. Share it with other people freely, and 1,000 more gifts will come our way. What an amazing thing to think about. Listen to young people in our lives, because they have so much to offer. This story literally went on overnight. There's a lot more animals, and each of the animals has a specific gift that resonates with the story. So I wanted to share that, especially with you young people, because I think you all have amazing gifts. Oh, son of a gun. I think you better have that then, because I don't want it in my drum anymore.